The following program is a PBS Wisconsin original production.
I'm Frederica Freiber. Tonight, Wisconsin Responds, a Here and Now special. We're bringing you an hour tonight on outcry over the death of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer. We speak with community leaders, organizers, and lawmakers about their local perspectives on the national conversation. It's Here and Now for June 5.
Funding for Here and Now is provided by the Focus Fund for Journalism and Friends of PBS Wisconsin.
Rallies and protests spread across Wisconsin over the death of George Floyd, who died under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer now being charged with second-degree murder. Protesters taking to the streets daily, chanting, holding signs, and even shutting down highways to spread their message to end police brutality against African Americans. Various acts of vandalism, looting, and fires occurred, some say by protesters and some say by agitators. Some days there was no visible police presence, while on many other days police in riot gear broke up crowds with tear gas, pepper spray, and rubber bullets. On Sunday, Governor Tony Evers activated the National Guard to assist local law enforcement across the state. As to law enforcement, police reform is an immediate action item. Advocacy groups have released lists of demands on that front. More than 65 organizations co-signed such a list, published by the African American Roundtable in Milwaukee. It includes calling for police to stop using rubber bullets and tear gas on protesters, doing away with curfews, withdrawing the National Guard, and shifting funds away from the police and putting that money toward health and housing initiatives. Joining me now is Angela Lang, Executive Director of Black Leaders Organizing Communities, or BLOC. She joins us from Milwaukee, and thank you so much for doing so.
Thanks for having me. I think this conversation is important. Thank you.
Why has every state in the nation and Wisconsin risen up to protest the killing of George Floyd?
Yeah, I mean, I get this question a lot. I think, you know, we've seen murders at the hands of police for decades now. You know, even the Rodney King beatings, this is not something that's new for us. But I think, you know, the way I kind of frame it and the way I think about it is that it's like a soda can that's just been shaken up for years and decades and with no real tangible solutions in ways for real, truly policy reform. To me, I feel like this was only a matter of time. I tell people all the time, I was in college when Trayvon Martin was murdered. And, you know, Dontre Hamilton in 2014 in Milwaukee and Saville Smith in 2016. And this feels different. It feels that, you know, society, Black and brown and indigenous folks, we're all saying enough is enough. And, you know, we keep seeing these things happen. There's these outcries. And then a couple months later, it seems to go back to business as usual. And I think what we're seeing is really community and society as a whole saying enough is enough. And we want real policy and legislative changes.
Because what does Floyd's death represent?
I think it represents murder at the hands of police due to a structural system that's really rooted in white supremacy. When we think about law enforcement, we can really look at the history of sheriff's departments and law enforcement in general that were really enacted during slavery to catch runaway slaves. And when you're founded on that history and, you know, the system has only evolved, it still has its roots in white supremacy. And we've seen just these killings and these murders really just be at the hands of law enforcement that are meant to protect us. It represents the Black and brown bodies that are being criminalized merely for existing. You know, you can't walk down the street. You can't listen to loud music. You can't sleep on a park bench. There's so many things that we can't do, and we're being criminalized just for merely existing. We can't run away. We can't wear a hoodie. We can't buy Skittles. There's so many different things that we are criminalized doing. And I think his death and quite frankly, his murder is really a symbolic of how Black people and brown people are viewed in this country and the stereotypes and threats that people think and impose on us.
How exhausting is it for you and others to fight the same fight over and over again?
It's incredibly exhausting. It's draining. It's traumatizing. It's triggering. It's emotional. It's something that seems like it's an ongoing issue. I've been organizing for about 12 years now, and pretty much since day one, I haven't always organized around these issues, but these issues always crept up and really intersected in the organizing that I was doing. And it seems that things aren't changing. And so much has happened in our country and in the city and in the state just in the last week and a half. And being honest, I cried a lot this last week and a half. Last weekend, I needed to turn my phone off and take a mental health break. I woke up Friday at 2 to 3 o'clock in the morning and seeing Donald Trump's tweets about if the looting starts shooting. All of that is incredibly dangerous and frightening for communities of color, and to have to constantly, you know, be in the streets, either taking a knee like Colin Kaepernick and peacefully protesting or escalating, it seems that we're not being heard. And we have to really beg for our own dignity and for our lives to be just as valued as our allies and as white folks. And it's incredibly exhausting to constantly have conversations and to constantly be in this fight to really just amplify our own dignity that people, for whatever reason, don't naturally see.
One of the things organizers and advocates have signed on to is an official declaration of racism as a public health crisis. What would follow from that kind of declaration?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I think that's a first step, is to really label how racism has impacted us, whether it's in terms of trauma or being murdered at the hands of police and everything in between. It is a public health issue. When Black girls are going missing or being trafficked, that is a public health issue. When Indigenous women and girls are going missing, that's a public health issue. And we should be treating racism like that as such. When we see trans women specifically being murdered and hate crimes on the rise, all of that, those are hate crimes, and that should be treated as a public health issue. And we need policies to really protect all of the marginalized communities. We need to be able to understand the white supremacy that is deeply entrenched in our law enforcement and in our policies, how we're able to express ourselves, understanding our limitations. And we're not really offered the ability to thrive and to dream the way that other communities are. And so I think it really goes to really evaluating how money is allocated, whether it's on a statewide level or even on the local level. In Milwaukee, nearly 50% of the city budget goes to the police department, while the health department, which houses the Office of Violence Prevention, is only funded at about 2 to 3%. That is an incredible lopsided budget, and it really doesn't prevent crime, and it doesn't protect our communities. And so we really need to think about how we're investing and ideally divest from the criminal justice system. You know, typically we spend more on the Department of Corrections and the Department of Justice than we do on our education system. That goes to show what our values are, and budgets truly are moral documents, and we really need to allocate dollars to actually divesting from the police department and putting it into resources such as mental health, making sure everyone has access to quality health care, to quality education, to youth opportunities in the summer, transportation so people can get to living wage jobs. All of those things are factors about a safe community and lead us to actually have a decrease in crime instead of actually spending so much money on law enforcement that, as we're seeing right now, is only escalating the crime.
In the wake of George Floyd's death, has violence in the streets during protests co-opted the message in your mind and taken attention away from the discussions of racism and deaths of Black people and these inequities of which you speak?
You know, I think the violence or the looting is being framed in a difficult way. No one wakes up and is so angry and is so traumatized. No one wants to wake up and be that angry and burn something down. And I think it's not really our job to tell people how they should deal with their trauma when we're seeing very public executions. You know, people are saying that these are modern day lynchings. And we saw when Colin Kaepernick took a knee and he peacefully protested, and the backlash And so, you know, for people to kind of, for lack of a better term, tone police how people are expressing their trauma and frustration, it's difficult. And I think it's taking away from the message of the pain and the hurt. And again, it's not ideal. No one wants to be burning things down in order to be heard. But I think there are some times where people feel that that is the only way. You protest peacefully, you're not being heard. And so I think it's natural, and I think it's understandable that people feel the need to lash out in this way. And we really need to, in that particular conversation, we really need to be centering people's lives over the value of property. At the end of the day, property can be replaced. People's lives cannot.
Midweek, as you know, criminal charges were upgraded against the Minneapolis police officer who knelt on the neck of George Floyd, and the other officers are now being charged. What's your reaction to that?
You know, I think it's a step in the right direction. You know, it's encouraging. We'll see how the system plays out. If I'm honest, I'm never too reliant and too confident on the criminal justice system as how things play out. We see how it disproportionately impacts our community. And we've seen time and time again, officers being acquitted. And just because charges may be brought, we really want to see the charges be able to stick and people actually being able to be held accountable. And I think also, you know, I get this question too, is, you know, just because charges are brought, do I think that the protests are going to die down? And I think we're living on this precipice right now that it is so much bigger than George Floyd. I think people are really starting to understand that this is a systemic problem. And this may have been the catalyst and the spark for that change, but people are really peeling back the layers in the historical context of everything that brought us to this point. And so even if everything plays out the way that we want it to, we also need to make sure that we're making concrete reforms in the future to make sure that this is never something that can ever be allowed to happen again.
Angela Lang, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thousands turned out across Wisconsin to protest in the wake of George Floyd's death, at times causing clashes between police and demonstrators. The common theme running throughout, systemic racism needs to end. Here and Now reporter Will Keneally has more.
The emotion that filled Wisconsin's streets this week was palpable. For one protester who pointed to her skin when asked why she was demonstrating,
it's never gonna end.
The death of George Floyd in Minneapolis police custody sparked movements across the state, advocating changes to how the police interact with Black communities.
We want community control over the police, which will lead to the abolishment of this police as we understand it.
Yeah!
And instead, we want those resources to be redirected to pro-Black, to pro-life affirming safety mechanisms.
The push for police reform has gone on for years in Wisconsin. And the police shooting deaths of Tony Robinson in Madison and Seville Smith in Milwaukee were front of mind during this week's protests. The frustration over the lethargic pace of change reached a boiling point over the weekend. Police clashed with protesters and storefronts were pillaged.
Some of us are upset about the looting. I get it. Some of us are upset about the property. I get it. But ain't nobody offering no solutions or policy change.
Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway advocated local change, but the crowd in Madison was unconvinced.
I will work to do what I can, and I will stay in dialogue with Em and Brandy.
To move forward and rebuild trust in the police, what can be done?
One, we have to take a step back and realize that we cannot tell hurt people, traumatized people who have been suffering so much pain, how to react to their trauma. We also have to be conscious that we all have a role to play in the movement. Every role isn't for everybody, but we all have a role to play in this movement. It's about recognizing that role. This is really about, you know, how we lean on one another.
It is time to move in that direction to acknowledge race exists. I hope no one knows who's coming back to the Capitol, right? That we have a new tone. It's not just a black issue. If people turn on the TV, our white brothers and sisters are marching too. It's a human issue.
For many, it's a chance to be heard.
People are coming together and we're making artwork to speak about the value of black lives and make it more visible. You can speak about it, but I think it helps for people to see why we are angry and why we are upset and how we can come together and hopefully make things better one day. So,
reporting from Madison and Milwaukee, I'm Will Keneally for Here and Now.
These words from Governor Tony Evers this week, quote, "We must reject the efforts of those who seek to undermine and distract from the pain of generations of injustice." He says, "We must condemn all those who encourage violence against black lives. We must offer our compassion. We must offer our support. But most of all," he says, "we must offer our action." And Governor Tony Evers joins us once again in our weekly one-on-one interview. And thanks very much for doing so.
And thanks, Frederica.
So the tangible action that you want to take comes in the form of a legislative bill that would make the primary duty of all law enforcement to preserve the life of all individuals and that deadly force is to be used only as a last resort. Why is that what you call an important first step?
Yeah, and that's great because that's what brought us to where we are today. Obviously, the horrible murder that we saw in Minneapolis with George Floyd and how that happened because there wasn't the accountability piece in place as it relates to police and relations and interactions with folks. And so use of force is what we're looking for. It's an assembly bill. It's already there. It's really straightforward. It's about making sure those standards exist so that everybody, both the community and the police, know what is expected of them.
Now,
I'm sorry, but it is only a first step. We have an opportunity now that goes, obviously police relations and criminal justice reform, housing, you name it, we have an opportunity now to really move the needle.
Specific to that use of force bill, yeah. It is certainly being criticized by the chair of the state Senate Public Safety Committee, who is our next guest on this program. He says it was written, quote, by liberal activists who don't know anything about police work. What do you say to that?
Well, it was written in large part by the people that were sitting in that are protesting using the First Amendment rights. I understand that the senator has lots more criminal justice and police experience than others do, but that doesn't mean that we can't move forward on something around accountability for police. 90%, 95%, you name the high number of people that work in the profession are good. We need accountability for people that, frankly, need some help in establishing standards. That you don't have to be a former police officer to understand that.
What about mandating and funding implicit bias training for law enforcement, something like that?
Absolutely. There are all sorts of good ideas on the table. And as I've talked to people all across the state, but in particularly Madison and Milwaukee, on the ground, I'm not talking about elected officials, the people that are living this every single day, they say, and they are accurate, there are enough blue ribbon commissions and enough task forces and enough other things that there are ideas out there that can be implemented. And so I'm looking forward to getting the best ideas, especially from those people that are on the ground. Obviously, we have to get support from legislators, but this should be a bipartisan issue.
Thursday, you declared racism a public health crisis. What tangible steps will you take to heal that crisis?
Yeah, it's been laid bare during this pandemic, which groups are inordinately and disproportionately impacted by the virus. It's African-Americans, it's Hispanics, and other people of color. So, and we've been talking about this a long time, frankly. I still believe that taking the Medicaid expansion money that we could have done in the last budget would have freed up lots of money for other programs that would have directly impacted the lives of people of color in this state and helped to reduce that disproportionality. To me, it's unacceptable that we have not taken the money that our taxpayers have sent to Washington, D.C., and we're getting no benefit from that.
What is your position on defunding the police and putting those funds toward things like public health, housing, or economic development on behalf of people or people of color?
Yeah, I've been asked that question a lot, and possibly even some of the folks you're talking to tonight are going to be talking about that. But if defunding means remove funding from police officers and the work that they're doing, the good work that they're doing, of course, I'm not against that. Who's going to be arresting the person driving 100 miles an hour on the Beltline dead drunk? I mean, we have to have some police out there to help us get through these things. But if some of that money could be used differently around, as you talked about before, implicit bias training, psychological help for officers that are working under traumatic circumstances all the time, reappraising how that money is spent to help them become better police officers, I'm all for that.
Among the other demands, as you said, that was one, and we will hear about that tonight from some people. But among other demands from anti-racist activists and advocates is to withdraw the National Guard activated in the midst of protests, which, as you know, some of them resulted in widespread property damage. Will you see to that demand?
Well, first of all, the National Guard is sent in when locals ask us for it. So in Milwaukee and Madison and other places in the state. But my role or my insistence and bottom line is that they serve a limited role. I understand how people feel about military organizations, even though our National Guard has done a great job helping us in the pandemic. So we have insisted with local leaders that they are primarily used to protect property, especially important property like the state capitol, like electrical situations and water and other utilities, cultural sites. So that's their role, and that's how that's the role they're primarily playing. So until they are asking me to have them play a more active role, we will continue to do what I think they're doing a great job as.
You say that we must reestablish trust with communities of color. How do you do it?
It's a long process, but believe me, we have a long way to go. And one of the things we can do is act. And I believe at the state level, we have some actions that we can take to help people that struggle, people of color in the state of Wisconsin. But also, we have to make sure that we involve the entire state in this. Our state is becoming more diverse by the day, and we'll continue to operate under that umbrella of changing demographics. And so we need to have these conversations. I think the state has a bully pulpit role to play, but more importantly, an active role, an action role that relies on interacting with people on the, elected officials are fine. We're going to continue those conversations. But the more I and other state leaders spend time speaking to people on the ground in cities and villages across the state on this issue, the better off we'll be.
And you're committed to doing that in the days and weeks ahead.
Yeah, always have been. This is an issue that I have, it's been burning in my soul for years. And we have a good opportunity in the state of Wisconsin. People are protesting around some really important things. And I'm looking forward to delivering on some of the things they're interested in.
Governor Tony Evers, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Frederica. Appreciate it.
The legislative bill that calls for making the primary duty of law enforcement to preserve the life of all individuals and that deadly force is to be used only as a last resort is being derided by the Republican state senator who is chair of the Public Safety Committee. Senator Van Wongard of Racine is a former police officer. He joins us now from Racine, and thanks very much for being here.
I'm glad to be here, Frederico.
So why, in your mind, is it wrong to codify in statute that the primary duty of law enforcement is to preserve the life of all individuals?
Well, actually, under Chapter 66, it's already included in there, and it requires each department to have policies in place, both under state and federal guidelines, that restrict those officers to acting in accordance with state and federal laws. So just like what happened in Minnesota, this officer that stepped outside of his department's policies, guidelines, and training and did this horrific positioning of his knee on the suspect's neck, that individual was outside of the policies and guidelines of the force continuum, and he's been charged with second-degree murder. We have all kinds of criminal statutes on the books that apply to everybody. They apply to police officers, too. Not just the people on the street that they police, but the police officers themselves. And those guidelines are already in place under Chapter 60 and under Chapter 6213, which deals with police and fire commissions, et cetera. There are several layers that would be involved in the process if, in fact, an individual steps outside of those guidelines. And I just like to point out, I was a police and fire commissioner for 10 years also.
And so you describe this proposal as being micromanaging of police departments. And you also say that it seems clear that whoever wrote this bill has never served with law enforcement. Why do you say that piece?
Well, I say that because no matter what is in this bill would not have changed what occurred in Minneapolis. And I don't believe it would have changed any of the officer-involved incidents that have occurred in my recent memory. We need to get at the root cause of why this is happening, and we need to look at specifically how can we address those issues. So we have a piece of legislation that we've been working on about 2 years. We've been working on it with Mr. Michael Bell. He lost his son to a police officer down in Kenosha a few years back, and he has been looking for change in how we address some of the officer-involved shootings and how can we train better so that maybe we can alleviate some of these issues happening. So we've been working on that piece of legislation, which would get to the root cause. It would look specifically like the National Transportation Safety Board comes in when there's a transportation crash for public transportation, something like that. They come in, they survey all of the information. There's no place they can't go. They can subpoena, they can do all those different things, find out why it happened so that we can go in and make changes so we don't have these failures. Whether or not a black man on the ground or a white man on the ground would have made any difference. What this officer did was just absolutely horrendous, and he should be charged. So that wouldn't have made any difference, you know. So we need to look at what happened here. Where was the failure? And I think that the process, we will now have, not only will they have an internal investigation, they'll have their State Department of Justice, I'm sure, in Minneapolis is looking at it. I know that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Department of Justice at the federal level and the state level in Minnesota would be looking at it, just as we have happened here when there's an officer involved death. So I think we need to keep all of that in perspective.
You talk about root causes of this kind of thing, like happened in Minneapolis, happening. Would that be training and accountability then?
I think training is a huge, huge part of it. We're blessed here in Wisconsin. We've got a really good Bureau of Training and Standards, and they work very closely with all of our departments. I guess I lean a little bit towards southeastern Wisconsin with Gateway Technical College and MATC. But they train our officers. They have two-year programs, and they're hands-on, and they're phenomenal. And then every officer in the state of Wisconsin is required to have 24 hours of continuing education to maintain their certifications. So So they go through all of the other aspects of interaction with the community, which could be mental health issues. It could be DAP training, defensive tactics for arrest. I mean, all those different things are trained over that minimum 24-hour period. So we're really fortunate to have that. And they upgrade that training. So every year an officer has to have at least 24 hours of training for updating on current things that might change how they respond to the community.
All right. Senator Wongard, we need to leave it there, but thanks very much.
Welcome.
Our next guest is nationally recognized in the field of police reform. Noble Ray is the former chief of Madison Police and longtime officer. He is now a consultant for community and trust-based policing methods across the country. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So as an expert in police practices and reform, when you saw the images of what happened to George Floyd, what went through your head?
First of all, just like many Americans, it was just horrific to see that just emotional. There's just a lot of emotions going through my head. You know, I feel it from a community member, an African-American male, or someone that's been in policing for now over 30 years, really. And, you know, I felt for the family. It was just a terrible set of circumstances.
So putting even a finer point on that, how well do you understand the anger of protesters marching in solidarity over racism and white supremacy as they mourn the death of another black man?
I understand it from different angles. I came up in Milwaukee. My parents and my family was very much involved with Father Grabbe and the civil rights movement. And so that rings very, very strong for me. As a police officer, as one that has advocated for police, but also police reform, it hit me hard because all of those gains that we thought that we were making over the years, you know, and recognizing that trust can be lost in just one instant, So that was very difficult. But understanding that talking to community members, both here in Madison and across the nation, this is a real issue. It's been a real issue. And one of the things that I think we do by mistake in our profession is that if there is an absence of tension or if people are not complaining to law enforcement, it sends a signal that things are okay. But in reality, this is a perfect example that things are not okay. The tension was out there. The frustration, the decades of frustration was out there. And then this was the match that really hit at the core of so many people. And one of the other things I'd like to say, Frederica, this is different. I've been in a lot of protests. I mean, Madison is a state capital. This is not a protest. This is a movement. And a movement happens when the people that are directly impacted by a particular issue, they're not the only ones impacted. This has gone beyond African-Americans. This is worldwide. The other thing in a movement is when you see a shift in status quo thinking. What I'm hearing out there is people are asking for something different. They're saying, we want a response to police misconduct to happen in a more rapid fashion. We want police officers that are engaged in similar conduct to be treated just like an average citizen would be treated. And it should be. If we're the guardians of democracy, we should be held to a higher standard.
Do you think that those calls will be different this time? Will this be the situation that causes change?
I hope so. I hope that the change that takes place, the reform that takes place, goes beyond the moment. And as I alluded to earlier, we get lulled into thinking just because people are not out there protesting that there's not an issue, because there are clear issues of reform that need to take place in this profession.
I'll
give you an example. I think law enforcement needs to provide automated disciplinary records to the public. It needs to be transparent. It needs to be done in a way where, you know, human resource issues are protected within the department. But I think, you know, over time, people need to know what's happening on a disciplinary standpoint. I think Graham versus Connor, the Supreme Court, the landmark Supreme Court decision that took place in the 80s regarding use of force, I think those things need to be looked at. I'll give you, just drilling down into that a bit more. There's a proposal at the state level, and that proposal is to look at how do we focus in on the minimal amount of force necessary in a use of force situation. California has passed legislation kind of similar to that. What Grant versus Connor did, which there are aspects of it that I really like, but it moved us away from focusing in on the minimum amount of force, which I think has a more of a moral objective in the operations of police when they're dealing with force, when they're dealing with the use of force. So that is always, when I came on, that was always in the back of my mind. Use the minimum amount of force necessary when you're engaged in that situation. I think we lost that under the objectively reasonable standard that came out of the Graham versus Connor decision.
And so do you support the proposal that exists at the state, a bill by Democrats that deals with use of force? You support that provision?
I have not seen the bill, so I'm always reluctant to say that I support it in its entirety until I see it. I have just heard about it. And from what I've heard, I think it's going in the right direction. I'd like to see the legislation, but I know that I was tracking California's legislation on it, and I think they're going in the right direction with it.
The legislation seems fairly brief. It basically says that the primary duty of officers is to preserve the life of all people and use deadly force as a last resort. There are some other provisions, but those are the two main prongs.
I think that's going in the right direction. Again, I followed the California legislation, and they had to work that through the language so that it met the needs. But what it comes down to, one of the things that we have lost as it relates to use of force in policing is language, statutory language, Supreme Court language that reinforces the morality, the ethics, the humanity of policing. And I think that legislation that's being proposed is trying to get at that.
Very briefly, what learned wisdom would you impart on current police officers?
Learned wisdom is this. I think policing has really evolved. I think we've made great strides. But the learned wisdom is that it's constant. We lose sometimes because we get caught up in the day-to-day push of things. I mean, we're out there fighting fires, and it is a difficult job. But the things that are important about our profession, building trust, connecting with people, procedural justice, the competency and the character that it takes to do this job, the guardianship which we're entrusted with, that takes work, and it's every day, and it's hard to do. And so that is something that we still have to emphasize.
We leave it there. Noble Ray, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So what is the situation on the ground with practicing cops, those still responding and engaging and making decisions? For that, we go to Green Bay and check in there with the chief of police, Andrew Smith. And, Chief, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So I have read that you intend a refresher course for your officers in the use of force in the wake of what happened in Minneapolis. How important do you believe that kind of regular training is for your officers?
I think it's critical. I think our officers need to know what their job is. They need to know what the rules are for their job. And we already started that. We met with all of our supervisors just last week, and we all sat down. We went over the Minnesota incident. We had our use of force trainers there. And the expectation is that every officer will receive a refresher on what happened in Minneapolis, what our policies say, and what our expectations are for our officers.
Do your officers use methods like holding handcuffed suspects down on their necks?
No. That's specifically prohibited by our policy. We do not do that.
And so if you had a refresher on use of force, what were the kind of most cogent takeaways from that for your officers?
Well, we gave them a kind of a little bit of an overview about why we're able to use force, under what situations force is appropriate. But also we talked about the officer override. If you see another officer using force that's unauthorized or misapplying force, we believe it's the responsibility of those officers to stop that from happening. And that was reiterated along with the basic rules of, you know, you don't put your knee on someone's neck. You don't put them down to the ground and hold them down pinned like that. And if somebody's gasping for air or calling for help, you take that as a serious incident and needs to be acted on.
You also say that law enforcement has a long way to go in terms of accountability. How so?
Well, I think, you know, it's a tough job out there, and there's a lot of great officers doing great work every day. But I think that we all come across the bad apple that you hear about. We come across officers who have a long history of getting in trouble. And I think it's awful tough to fire someone, quite frankly, that needs to be fired here in Wisconsin. And so I think it's incumbent upon the chiefs of police to make sure that they are holding their officers accountable at all levels. And I think the chief needs to be held accountable, too. We have a civilian police and fire commission here in Green Bay that holds me accountable. But I think across the board and across the country, accountability for officers is lacking, and it's really, really tough to fire a bad officer.
You marched with protesters in your city last weekend. What was that like?
Well, it's not the first time I've marched with protesters. Coming from Los Angeles, I've done that many times. But I was quite happy to be invited into the protest when they asked me to march with them. And, of course, I did. And what really I wanted to do was have the opportunity to listen to people, to hear what they say, to hear what they're concerned about, understand their anger and understand their frustration. But I really wanted to hear it from the people that were marching. You know, what's on your mind? What could we do better as a police department here in Green Bay?
Before that, you commented about how George Floyd died, saying it sickened you and it was one of the most horrible things that you had ever seen. While reading your statement and, you know, about how you marched with the protesters, we also came upon an article, and it gives me kind of no pleasure to raise this, about a family whose loved one was killed by police bullets in your city. And they called you out for your hypocrisy, saying, quote, "We're outraged and deeply offended that you would use this time of tragedy to make those statements," saying that your department is not at fault, they said, for the same unjust actions that have occurred to George Floyd's family. What is your comment on that?
Well, first of all, there's a lawsuit pending, so I can't speak about any of the specifics of that cases. But these were two completely different cases. This one has already been reviewed. The one in Green Bay has already been reviewed by the district attorney's office, who declined to press any charges, of course. So they are two very different cases. I understand that family is very upset, but again, there's a lawsuit pending. So I really can't talk about any specifics of that.
All right. Well, Chief, we really appreciate you joining us, and we wish you and your city well. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Earlier this week, Marissa Wojcik sat down with the founder of Urban Triage and Madison organizer Brandi Grayson to hear what their demands are and what protests look and sound like on the ground.
Can you describe for us what this past week of protests at the state's capital has looked like and sounded like to you?
The protests have been very powerful. In the sense that it's cross-generational, cross-races, cross-ideology, right? Like, it's just a mixture of beautiful, brilliant people who are really fed up with the systemic oppression, right? Really fed up with white supremacy and the killing of Black bodies without justice. And I think when George Floyd was murdered on camera in the following the death of Ahmaud, who was chased down by KKK supremacists, it was just enough, right? And with the mixture of COVID, people being isolated and just being tired of being just oppressed and having their rights taken away from them. So what I've seen on the ground, it was really a feeling of community, right? And this sense of we are in this together. And that we will be the ones that save us and protect us. And we must keep going until our voices are heard and real action is taken. And for us in Madison, Wisconsin, real action looks like defunding our jails, our police department, investing in people, investing in our children, investing in youth. And one of the other demands is firing Matt Kinney, who currently is a police officer with Madison Police Department, who murdered Tony Robinson in 2015, shot him 7 times. So we are asking that there be real actions taken as it relates to the violence inflicted on human bodies. And what we've been witnessing is community. And what we're also demanding is community control over police. We need community review boards to have the same power as the police and fire commission. And that power can be granted to community members through our city council and through the police and fire commission. And it is another one of our demands is free them all. So free them all means all Black people currently locked up in Dane County Jail. And that responsibility and power specifically falls on our Dane County, our executive, right? Dane County Executive Joe Parisi and our sheriff. So they have the power to let people out. And what we know is when COVID hit, they did let people out, right? And so we know that they can if they really are in, if they really are interested in justice and a fair system.
And I did want to ask you about your demands. Your organization, along with Freedom Inc. and the Party for Socialism and Liberation, have made this list of demands. Are these demands in line generally with what others are calling for across the country?
Yes, it's in line with the Black movement, movement for Black lives, defunding the police, reparations for Black people, and really building resources for the Black community. And with the understanding that when we get to the point where we're uplifting Black people and we're supporting Black people with opportunity, resources, and justice, then everyone is liberated.
Where do you see things going? What do you believe the outcome of these protests will be? Or do you foresee yourself protesting every day for weeks and months to come?
You know, that's a hard question. That's totally up to those in power. It's totally up to our federal government, our local police departments, our local mayors, our local Dane County executive, our sheriffs. If folks want this to end, then there has to be some changes. I don't see it stopping until some real actionable steps happen. This is historical. There is a revolution happening and taking place across our country. I don't see it ending. I see it increasing until real actionable steps are taken to end the violence against Black bodies at the hands of our police state. And again, our people in charge that have power, they have the power to end this at any moment. So the question really is when the protesters are going to stop. The question is when are those in charge and in power going to start doing things to protect Black bodies?
All right, Brandi Grayson, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
A man who has made bridging gaps and bringing communities together his life's work describes the protests and riots as the voices of those who are fed up around the country, who are marginalized on their jobs, priced out of their neighborhoods, overcharged for payday loans, and overpoliced. Michael Johnson, president and CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, joins us now. And thanks very much for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
So you called what happened to George Floyd a modern-day lynching. Describe how this feels for you and the communities you serve.
You know, when I saw it, I was at a grocery store with my wife. And me and my wife met at the University of Minnesota. We went to school at the University of Minnesota. I played football at the University of Minnesota. I have family that live in the southern part of Minneapolis. So when I was when I saw it, I immediately broke down in tears. I was devastated by what I saw. I watched my wife come home and watching on CNN and watched her break down in tears. And so what we saw it was devastating. It was heartbreaking. And to know that we live in 2020 and that these kinds of things continue to happen to people who look like me is just not acceptable.
There's been a lot of talk on this program and others about the use of force protocol for police officers. But in your mind, is what happened in Minneapolis the symptom of something much deeper?
Yeah, I think we do have systemic racism in our country that we have to not only address. We talk a lot about racial disparities. We talk about systemic, you know, racism. But what we don't do as a country is make the appropriate investment to address systemic racism. You can only address systemic racism as if you make it a financial priority. A lot of times, if you look at local municipalities, they talk about it. And then when you look at their municipal budgets, it just doesn't align with the plans.
So what kinds of funds should they be putting toward things in municipal budgets?
I mean, you look at, you know, Wisconsin. I love this state. I've lived here for 10 years. But we've been talking about racial disparities for 50 years. And the fact that we have African-American kids and other kids of color not graduating at the same rates of their white counterparts is a symptom of the lack of investment that we've placed in our schools. And so that's an issue within itself. And then when you look at the health disparities and the lack of resources for African-American families and other families of color, it's fundamentally the kind of financial support that's needed is not there. And a lot of times, agencies that are led by people who look like me don't necessarily get the financial support to be able to do this work at all different levels across the spectrum.
And so would you describe that as systemic institutionalized racism?
I would say when you look at, just go look at the boards of directors of our large companies here. Look at the C-suites of people who are in the CEO, the COO, and the CFO seats. Look at the managers of most of the organizations that run the corporations, you know, in our state. Look at our nonprofit leaders. And so when you don't have diversity and inclusion, that's a form of systemic racism. When you look at the inadequate funding opportunities to address these issues, that's a form of systemic racism. And so those are the challenges that we see, you know, not only in Wisconsin, but across the country that we have to begin to address. Or what will happen, we'll be talking about these issues 15, 20 years from now, because we have not made the appropriate investments. We have not come up with the appropriate vision and the priorities to support eradicating these issues that address our community.
Protests and rallies have happened across the country and here at home. As you know, some have turned violent. Some organizers are unapologetic about that, whereas you call for peaceful protests, and you're even readying to hire like 75 peacekeepers. What will they do?
Yeah, so one of the things I was concerned about, you know, immediately when I saw the protest that happened in Madison started off very peaceful. It was beautiful. You saw Black people, white people, young people, gay, straight, the LGBT community. It was a beautiful thing. And I ended up getting a phone call from the mayor while I was out riding my bike, asking for support. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I saw outside agitators. I saw people influencing young people to break into businesses. And it's unacceptable. We should never, ever utilize the name of somebody that was killed to promote criminal activity. So I decided to hire 75 peacekeepers who would be there to support the protesters, to be there to offer water, to be there if there's an emergency issue, to be able to call EMS workers, but also serve as a liaison that if somebody's doing something that's going to agitate and create an unhealthy environment, We want to be there to de-escalate those kinds of issues. And let me say this, too. I'm sorry. Let me say this, too, that we've been talking to the police department. Our protest here in Madison has been peaceful the last two nights. We asked the police chief to demilitarize his police force. He listened. And I think because of that and because we have adults out there that want a healthy environment, it has been very, very peaceful the last two days.
With just about a minute left, what is your hope as we move forward from this?
I'm hoping that that what happened to George Floyd never happens again. What happened to Eric Garner in New York never happens again. I hope that we begin to really not only talk about diversity and inclusion, but we act it out. I hope as a state and as a nation that we make a priority people who live in marginalized communities. What you see in our country is a lot of built-up anger from folks who have been marginalized, and it's going to take people that look like you and people that look like me and people who have influence to help change these critical issues that impact our country.
We leave it there. Michael Johnson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
For more information on the Wisconsin response to the death of George Floyd and calls for action and reform, head to our online news source at pbswisconsin.org and then click on News. Thank you for watching Here and Now. Stay tuned next for Race Matters, America in Crisis, a PBS NewsHour special starting at 8. We'll see you next week. I'm Frederica Freiberg. Stay well and have a great weekend.
Funding for Here and Now is provided by the Focus Fund for Journalism and Friends of PBS Wisconsin.